This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there. It's good to have you with us. I'm Joel Hilliker. The United Nations celebrates its 75th anniversary this year. The organization launched with great fanfare and optimism. This organization was really meant to be the world's best hope of avoiding a world war on the scale of what had just come through in World War II. But evidence of its impotence and corruption and failure abounds. The most recent example regards its rejecting of America extending an arms embargo on Iran. We're going to talk to Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this. We're seeing a lot of evidence these days of selective moral outrage. Progressives who speak out strongly against a specific injustice while turning a blind eye to incomparably worse injustices. The Vatican has spoken out strongly against injustices taking place in America, but it is apparently unconcerned about shocking human rights abuses in China. In our second segment, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about a secret deal the Vatican has made with China. In our January 2020 Trumpet edition, we had a cover story by Gerald Flurry titled, "Is K.T. Zu Gutenberg About to Come to Power?" Well, it's been 8 months, and he still hasn't come to power in Germany. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Josue Michels about what this former politician has been up to this year. And I'll finish the program today by talking about the solution to America's race problems. Let's start, though, by talking about the United Nations. For this, we have via Skype from our office in England, Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So, as I mentioned, it's been 75 years since the UN was founded. I'd like to start by just looking back at what inspired its founding. 1945, the world is just emerging from the worst war in history, and they create this organization that basically is trying to prevent anything so destructive from happening again. Maybe you can just set the table for us.
Right. So the United Nations got going before World War II ended, but you had this enormously destructive conflict. You know, somewhere around 60 million people died. The figure could even be dramatically higher than that. 200,000 of those people died due to just two bombs. And so as the United Nations forms, we're getting this frightening new form of explosives, atomic warfare. And now the possibility of mankind destroying himself is, you know, for the first time in history, something that people have to deal with, something that people have to get their heads around. So you've reached this point. You know, World War One was kind of never again, and man tried to devise a system that would stop war from happening ever again. Now that's failed, and you've had an even worse war. You've got an even more important reason why war must never happen again. You have the United Nations as this great push to try and learn from the failures of the League of Nations and the efforts for peace after World War One, and to deal with this new nuclear age that we're living in.
Now, at the time of the UN's founding, our founder Herbert W. Armstrong was actually there in attendance. And he said at the time, "I do not see peace being germinated here, but the seeds of the next war." And it's one of many statements that Mr. Armstrong made that we highlight in our free booklet. He was right. He was certainly right about the fact that the UN would not live up to the promise of solving the world's problems. Maybe you can just talk about some of the UN's record since that time.
Right. I think there are a lot of people in international relations at the moment who look at the United Nations and say, "We did it. You know, it worked. We created this organization to stop World War II from happening again, and it's not perfect, but it's been 75 years, and we've not had World War II. Job done." I mean, that's a pretty surface way of looking at things. If you look at a lot of, you know, as mankind's weapons has gotten more and more destructive, you've had this period where there's a greater and greater interval between wars, while the wars themselves get more destructive. So to say job done in the United Nations now is premature, to put it mildly. But then you start looking into, well, you know, what are the details of that record been like? What has this best hope for peace actually achieved? And yeah, like you said, it's not a great picture. You know, about 300 wars since the end of World War II, about 3,000 other conflicts, and you've got some major signs of things going badly wrong. You know, the job appointments from the United Nations read like a parody. You know, Iran going through all kinds of different positions on the UN Disarmament Commission, Syria as vice president of the Atomic Energy Agency, Zimbabwe chairing the Commission on Sustainable Development, Libya chairing a Council on Disarmament and International Security, Russia, China, Saudi Arabia, all on the Human Rights Commission, which, you know, you'll hear about, I'm sure, talk about some of the farcical nature of China being on a Human Rights Commission later in the show. There have been the massive scandals. You know, the UN's oil for food program has been labeled the biggest scam in history. It was meant to stop money from going to the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Instead, it funneled billions to Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. You had something similar happen in North Korea with the leader Kim Jong-il. You've had UN missions failing to prevent genocide. You've had UN missions carrying out atrocities of their own, particularly in the Congo in the 2000s with local women and teenage girls being raped. In Israel in the year 2000, you had soldiers on the UN peacekeeping mission cooperating with Hezbollah in order to kidnap three soldiers. Potentially less eye-catching, but I think perhaps more important, is you've had the role that the United Nations has played in kind of rehabilitating the German military, the Japanese military, you know, these militaries that had renounced militarism completely and said, you know, forever we're going to not deploy troops abroad. Then the United Nations has played a key role in breaking that taboo. Both nations broke that taboo as part of UN peacekeeping missions. And then they've gone on from there to get engaged in more and more international missions. And then you could go on for a whole segment on the UN's ridiculous treatment of Israel, where if you just judge by resolutions passed by the United Nations, that, you know, Israel causes more problems than all the rest of the countries in the world combined.
I hadn't really thought about the role that the UN has played in rehabilitating the German and Japanese militaries, but it is interesting. It just made me think, once we step back and we tell the tale of human history and we look at the way that all of these events unfolded, particularly in the end time leading up to the second coming of Jesus Christ, according to the prophecies of the Bible, how much of a role did the UN play in facilitating those things? It's an interesting question, because you can almost look at the UN as being the capstone of mankind's efforts to govern himself. And the fact that it actually, in so many cases, it actually did the opposite of what it was intended to do. I think it's going to become very clear when we are able to write the history books when it's all said and done. But let's just look at the most recent example here, maybe one of the more dangerous examples of the UN actually contributing to the world's problems. Tell us about this decision last Friday to allow Iran into the international arms market.
Right. So we think back to the Iranian nuclear deal pushed by the Obama administration about 5 years ago. One of the big provisions of that was that starting in October, unless the Security Council of the UN says otherwise, Iran's arms embargo would end. So since 2007, Iran has been banned from the global arms market. And, you know, think about everything that Iran has been able to do, all the news events that Iran has generated for the past 13 years. All of that has been done without Iran having a legal way to buy, you know, more advanced weapons from the Russians, the Chinese, and others, and just even, you know, just resupply its stocks of ordinary weapons from around the world. And so now you had this vote on Friday. Well, okay, we've had this arms embargo. Now we've got a vote on, do we want to extend that arms embargo or let it expire? And only one other country joined the United States in voting for the sanctions to be extended. Russia and China vetoed it. So they completely sunk it just by themselves. And then the European countries, including the UK, sat on the sidelines and abstained from even voting on that decision. So this Security Council decision gives Iran a huge boost. Brent Noctegaw wrote about this back in July. He said, up to this point, Iran has had to get by with weapons produced domestically, as well as an aging fleet of aircraft sold to Iran before the embargo began. And then we talked about all it's been able to do with this limited scope. But then he says, well, now the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism could be armed with conventional weapons that would tip the balance of power in the Middle East. You've got Iran now being able to buy Russian fighter jets that could reach Jerusalem or even Rome and Warsaw from Iranian territory. It can upgrade its submarines and do more to threaten the Straits of Hormuz. But then don't forget, it's not just Iran. You know, this is a nation that supports terrorist proxies all around the world. So ending the arms embargo opens up Iran to be able to buy all of these more advanced weapons and then funnel it on to its proxies in all of these different locations in the Middle East and beyond. So it's not just a huge boost for Iran, but for just terrorism in general. Now, you know, the UN, they don't bear sole blame for letting this happen and for this failure. It was U.S. President Barack Obama that pushed through this deal. And I think 5 years ago, it was entirely predictable that Russia and China would both, or at least one of the two, would veto any extension. So, you know, he set this in motion. And he had this deal that allowed Iran access to the arms market, even if it completely broke the deal. I mean, it has broken the Iran nuclear deal in so many different ways, but it still gets this massive benefit at this point. So it's not just the UN's failure, but it is a UN failure still. And it's a failure of man's last best hope for peace to step in here. And you know, you've got the world's number one state sponsor of terror, a power led by leaders that believe they can hasten the return of their messiah by starting World War III. And the UN, man's last best hope of peace, just failed to step in there and cut off this or stop this nation getting access to all of these weapons.
Yeah, we've drawn a lot of attention to the efforts of the Obama administration and the U.S. to aid the Iranian regime. It's really one of the most remarkable things about his presidency, and our editor-in-chief has drawn a lot of attention to that. But it's to think about the alignment between his administration and the United Nations is also another interesting aspect here that you have to look at this, and it only makes sense really in the context of what we've been talking about quite a lot in recent trumpet issues, this effort to blot out the name of Israel. And in a lot of ways, the United Nations has been an extraordinary weapon in accomplishing exactly that.
Yes, I agree. I mean, that article that Mr. McDonald wrote, that was the cover article of our trumpet print about the world kind of being out to get America, is something that stood out to me working on this trumpet brief, that you know, that even Europe, that even you know, France and Germany and even Britain stood on the sidelines and didn't support America here. You know, they stood on the, when it comes to whose side are we on, America or the world's number one sponsor of terror, they stood on the sidelines. And that says something very important about them. And yet you do see this anti-Americanism, I think, very strongly come through in this decision. I think for Britain it was a little different. I think it was part of a bet hedging. They think that this might help them win some brownie points if Joe Biden wins the election. But still, you've got all of these nations pursuing their own interest in the United Nations, and they see their own interest as taking America down a peg. And so Iran may have all of these crazy aspects about it, but supporting Iran means taking America down a peg. And so they'll support Iran.
I think these the overview that we're gaining from Gerald Flurry when he's talking about you know, blotting out the name of Israel in context of that passage in 2 Kings 16, it really does help us to understand the world in a way that we cannot really understand. I think a lot of people look at the United Nations and just kind of scratch their heads at what's going on here. But whether you're looking at the way that Gerald Flurry has been talking about this, or you go back to, like I mentioned earlier, what Herbert W. Armstrong said, even at the very beginning when the United Nations was founded, you really do gain insight into what's happening here that you can't get anywhere else outside of what Bible prophecy reveals.
I agree. I think what Mr. Armstrong gave right at the start of the United Nations is fascinating. I've got an article here that he wrote, or it might be a text of a broadcast, on April 29th, 1945 at the San Francisco conference, where the UN isn't even meeting. They're just getting together to come up with the United Nations Charter. And it's just this short 2-page little article, but it's filled with great analysis where he basically, right from day one of the United Nations, predicts its future for the next 75 years. Hmm. And actually, you can read this article that he wrote April 29th, 1945. You can go and get an international relations textbook that talks about the flaws of the United Nations. And you can see Mr. Armstrong identified them all in advance. He actually described them more simply and I think more profoundly than the textbook does, again, going all the way back to day one, which is what makes it – I mean it's easy to underappreciate that, I think, in hindsight. But to be able to say – to make so many specific forecasts with such certainty right from the beginning, it says a lot about the understanding the Bible gives. And that was all based on – the Bible's understanding of human nature. I mean, one of the subheads there is human nature causes war. He just talked about how everybody there at that conference, it was all about greed and getting, which is exactly what we see in the modern United Nations. And he had some specific critiques about the structure of the United Nations, the way that it only worked if great powers got their way, but letting the great powers get their way meant injustices. And he said, well, that's just going to keep on causing more wars. And then he talked about how, well, it just gets back to the way of peace. How do we have peace? And it's the same whether it's peace in families, peace within a nation, peace within the United Nations. And it's just not possible without God. So it was just some fascinating analysis that he put forward, like I said, right from day one.
Well, you can read some of that analysis in Richard's trumpet brief from yesterday. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the United Nations, and particularly its recent decision to allow Iran back into the international arms market. He wrote about this in his trumpet brief yesterday. This is our free daily email service, and we give you an analysis from one of our writers each day, and it links to the content on our website that helps you to understand your world. This is a great example of that. You can sign up for this free service at thetrumpet.com. But go check out Richard's article there on what is happening in the United Nations after 75 years of this organization's existence. Thanks so much for your time, Richard. Appreciate it.
Great to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A lot of people speak as though America is the most oppressive country in the world today. And at times, it seems like one prominent individual who believes that is the Pope. But if he's so concerned with human rights, why then is he so comfortable with China? We'll hear about this in this report from Andrew Miller.
75 years after the Holocaust, the Vatican is turning a blind eye to an authoritarian regime's attempt to exterminate an ethnic minority. That is the assessment of British human rights activist Benedict Rogers. In a July 29th foreign policy article, Rogers recounts how the president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews wrote a letter to the Chinese ambassador in London, comparing the plight of the Uyghurs in communist China to that of the Jews in Nazi Germany. Children have been taken from their parents and sent to state-run orphanages. Women have been forcibly sterilized. And drone footage shows Uyghur men kneeling and blindfolded, waiting to be loaded onto trains. 23 nations have formally condemned China's human rights abuses. But the Vatican has remained surprisingly silent, considering that Pope Francis is hailed as an advocate for the oppressed. The Pope has condemned the United States government for temporarily separating the children of illegal immigrants from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border, and he has spoken out against the murder of George Floyd at the hands of a U.S. police officer, saying, "We cannot tolerate or turn a blind eye to racism and exclusion in any form. Yet when it comes to communist China, he has turned a blind eye. He has not uttered a public prayer for the Uyghurs, the Hong Kongers, the Tibetans, or any other group persecuted by the Chinese Communist Party. Why? Well, according to Benedict Rogers, Pope Francis may not be allowed to criticize China's treatment of the Uyghurs under the terms of a secret agreement between the Vatican and Beijing. 2 years ago, the Vatican asked two Chinese bishops to step down and make way for two new bishops approved by the Chinese government. This was a prelude to a deal between the Roman Catholic Church and the Communist Party of China. The text of this deal remains secret, but what we know is that it gives an avowedly atheist regime a direct role in appointing Catholic bishops in China. And it may mandate the Pope's silence on Chinese human rights abuses. Before this deal was signed, about half of China's 12 million Catholics worshipped in underground churches that refused to recognize communist control over their faith. The other half worshipped in government-managed churches run by clergy appointed by the Communist Party of China. The deal with the Vatican was supposed to be a strategic compromise in the name of Catholic unity. But no Catholic clergy have been released from prison since the deal was signed. Instead, several more priests have disappeared. The last British governor of Hong Kong is warning that the Vatican is making a mistake by cozying up to China, just as it is slipping back into the most hardline dictatorship since Mao Zedong. And retired Cardinal Joseph Zen has said that signing a deal with communist China is analogous to signing a deal with Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin. Yet the Vatican still plans on renewing this deal with China next month. So in summary, Pope Francis turns a blind eye to China's egregious human rights abuses while praising Catholics who kneel at Black Lives Matter protests in the United States. This shows that human rights are not his primary concern. Instead, he is trying to accomplish a geopolitical goal. Uki Goni is an Argentine author whose research focuses on the Vatican's historic role in organizing rat lines to help Nazi criminals escape to Argentina. In a 2015 editorial for the New York Times, he wrote that you couldn't understand Pope Francis without acknowledging that his worldview was shaped in Juan Perón's Argentina. That is why Pope Francis often warns about the excesses of capitalism while expressing sympathy for communism and other forms of socialism. He follows the sort of Catholic socialism that was practiced in Argentina during Juan Perón's presidency. While still an archbishop in Argentina in 2010, he said, "If you were to read one of the sermons of the first fathers of the church from the second or third centuries about how you should treat the poor, you'd say it was Maoist or Trotskyist." So while the Pope disagrees with China's atheism, he is more sympathetic to China's Maoist economic system than he is to America's free market system. And this fact is key to understanding the geopolitical rationale behind China's Vatican deal. Suppose Pope Francis wanted to defeat American capitalism. To do so, he would need to convince Catholic nations across Africa, Europe, and Latin America to adopt a more socialist way of running their economies. And what better way to accomplish this goal than a deal with the world's leading communist economy? This deal with China is part of the Vatican's long-term strategy to achieve full diplomatic relations with Beijing, a vital step towards restructuring the world economy. Biblical passages such as Revelation 17 reveal that a powerful religious entity will rise up in the end time and become the guiding force over a great economic powerhouse that intoxicates all nations with its wealth and splendor. Revelation 18:3 says, "The merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury." Notice that these merchants are not only active in Europe or Latin America, they are merchants of the earth, doing business in all nations. Now, the late Herbert W. Armstrong explained in his book, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast?, that the religious entity referred to in Revelation 17 and 18 is headquartered in Rome. So atheist China is not going to lead the world's new economic order. But atheist China will ally with a revived Holy Roman Empire to replace the current Anglo-American economic system. The people of Rome once referred to the Chinese as the people of Cathay, after the Khitans of northern China. Both the Old Testament books of Isaiah and Ezekiel mention these people as Kittim. The Kittim form an end-time trade relationship with Tyre, which refers to the commercial heart of the Holy Roman Empire. Anyone concerned about the types of deals the Pope is making with totalitarian dictatorships needs to read Building Towards a World Catastrophe by Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. It explains the soon-coming alliance between Catholic Europe and Communist China. Both powers are prophesied to be instrumental in America's downfall.
Thank you very much, Andrew. So looking at the way that the Vatican is treating the United States versus China, it looks on its face like there's a big double standard here. While it hammers the United States for the way that it treats immigrants and these types of things, and then the way that it's overlooking this with China. But in reality, what you're saying is the Pope is prioritizing the economic goals that the Vatican has, which align with China, over human rights abuses.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not like a one-off thing with Pope Francis either, that this is just kind of something that he did in this particular case. Because if you can go back to the beginning of his papacy, it was one of his big goals and one of the goals he inherited from his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, to open up relations between America and Cuba. Cuba is also one of the, along with China, is one of the handful of countries that's still actually ruled by a communist party that uses the term communist party in its name. You have the Communist Party of China, the Communist Party of Cuba. Cuba's also got very egregious human rights abuses that the Pope has overlooked in this goal to like broker this deal, because you know that the Obama administration opened up relationships between America and Cuba for like the first time in 50 years. And now the Trump administration has since ruled some of that back. But one of the big overlooked angles, it seems like, when the media really covers that story, is that after 50 years of not talking to each other, that Barack Obama couldn't just call up Raul Castro. And so the Pope was the mediator, kind of in that deal where they were kind of bringing the two sides together, and so the Vatican orchestrated and made that deal with Cuba possible, trying to get America and Cuba trading again, in order to like throw a lifeline to the Cuban government. And just where before that America had been using economic sanctions to try to make their communist system collapse, so they could adopt a more freedom-loving system, the Pope was doing everything he could to make sure that he kept that system propped up, which does just really, really show he's tried to do similar moves, mediating between America and Venezuela. So between like Venezuela, Cuba, China, he's definitely trying to integrate the communist world into a new world economic system, yeah, and get them on the same page with the free market economies. And like that Argentine author said, is like really to understand like why he'd do that is that he follows the type of Catholic socialism that was followed in Juan Perón's Argentina, which isn't a pure Marxist form of socialism, but it's actually pretty close to the type of government state, what they call, what some people call state controlled capitalism, that's practiced in China today.
It is interesting how much the Pope his view of economics factors into the decisions that the Vatican makes about what sort of influence to extend in different parts of the world. And those prophecies that you mentioned in your report from Revelation 18 are, I think, they're some of the most chilling prophecies in the Bible when you look at the kind of economic power that that European superstate is going to exercise, and just how much, how the influence with the merchants of the earth, as it says there, is going to fuel those engines of empire there in Europe. And you see even the kinds of economic cooperation that are taking place between China and Europe today. We talk about the Mart of Nations prophecy quite a lot, and we're seeing more and more evidence of that, that they're willing to trade with one another. Here you have the Vatican, but you also have several European leaders who are quite comfortable with overlooking human rights abuses by the Chinese in order to gain the economic benefits from the relationship. You can put those in the context of what you read there in Revelation 18, and it is quite chilling to just see that coming together.
Right, yeah. When you, especially you go through that Revelation 18, and it's definitely in the context of, like you mentioned, this Mart of Nations, like Europe and China against the United States. So that right there tells you that the economy system is going to be more of a hybrid between Europe and China, which is much more. You take a hybrid between Europe and China, that's much more authoritarian than America's free market system. And then I didn't get to some of those verses today, but you read further in that chapter, and it even talks about trading in the souls of men, which shows that human rights abuses are not foremost on this these merchants of the mm-hmm. earth's mind, as you're talking like a revived slave trade between these powers, Europe and China, and these merchants, and just how comfortable some of these European and other nations are with what China is doing to the Uyghurs is really just chilling herald of the type of human rights abuses that chapter in Revelation talks about.
Well, we do appreciate that very much, Andrew. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the Vatican's relationship with China. He has an article up at thetrumpet.com called What You Need to Know About the Vatican's Secret Deal with China. Go check it out. Thank you very much for your time, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The Trumpet has long watched Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg as a potential candidate to become Chancellor of Germany. In fact, the cover story of our January 2020 Trumpet edition asked, is KT zu Guttenberg about to come to power? Well, he still hasn't come to power. We'll learn what he has been up to in this report from Josue Michels.
Since the former defense minister Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg moved to the US in 2011, news about his activities have indeed been sparse. We haven't learned much about him, and the mainstream media doesn't tend to report about him, at least not in the US. But in Germany there has been a lot of news about him, particular in 2011. Previously, most didn't even dare to discuss what Guttenberg spent his time with doing, but his recent activities are now laid open. In January, for example, Guttenberg caught Germany's attention once more with his comments about who will be succeeding Chancellor Angela Merkel. The news was soon followed in March by revelations about his involvement with the artificial intelligence company Augustus Intelligence. To this point, few, if any, have heard about Augustus Intelligence in Germany, but his involvement piqued the interest of the German public. Spiegel at the time revealed that Gutenberg served as president of General Affairs at Augustus and indicated even that this was at the time his full-time job. The company was at the time also accused of major fraud and deceiving investors, an accusation that I believe will stand as being proven true. Later Augustus dominated the news in Germany as it became known that the MP Philipp Amthor lobbied for the same company at the federal government, which sparked a huge debate if a politician who holds an investment in such a company and works with such a company should be lobbying for the same company at the federal government. It was also revealed that Gutenberg was denied a meeting with Chancellor Angela Merkel about the same company and declined meeting the economics ministry as Atmore did. Next, it became known that Gutenberg was involved with yet another scandal-ridden company called Wirecard, a company that was far more well-known than Augustus and also far more deeply involved in dubious affairs, as it later was revealed. Through his advisory company Spitzberg Partners, Gutenberg had direct access to Chancellor Angela Merkel, advised her on the company, and advocated Wirecard's takeover plans in China. Chancellor Merkel did indeed speak about the same company on her trip to China later that year in 2019. Wirecard's success as a startup company has been also unprecedented in Germany. Later, after it was exposed that the company used deceit and fraud to deceive investors, the scandal-riddled company fell in disgrace of the public opinion. It was even revealed that Germany's largest bank, Deutsche Bank, was involved in their deceit. The German Handelsblatt noted on July 22nd, "The fall of Wirecard is already the biggest scandal in the history of DAX, that's Germany's stock index, and it could even be the most extensive case of fraud in German economic history." And Gutenberg helped that same company to rise in the DAX index, which is very interesting considering Gutenberg's history. Gutenberg himself is not unfamiliar with fraud. It was revealed in 2011 that he had copied a large portion of his doctoral thesis at the University of Bayreuth. At the time, many hoped Gutenberg would regain the trust of the German people and perhaps even pursue a doctoral thesis legally again. That was a great hope for many of his fans, but it was seen as very unlikely that he even would be granted such a chance in Germany. But Gutenberg has indeed pursued such a chance abroad in England. The British University of Southampton accredited Gutenberg with a doctorate for his nearly 500-page publication, An Analytical Reconsideration of the Nature, Scope and Significance of Correspondent Banking and its Application in Historical Precedents and Selected Case Studies. Such a research probably didn't come to the mind for most Germans when they were thinking about him pursuing another thesis, but that's exactly the topic that Gutenberg has been studying ever since he left politics. German economics Richard Werner is said to have supervised the dissertation and rated it as excellently researched, according to Bild. Quite a statement considering that his last thesis was largely plagiarized and largely copy-pasted. Werner, on his part, has left the University of Southampton since and now claims that he was discriminated at the university for being German and Christian. Though Werner is highly regarded for his economic understanding, he has also been accused of holding close ties with right-wing circles. Which brings us back to Gutenberg. Gutenberg's association with him may be seen as a mishap, and is often so reported. But considering Gutenberg's involvement with Augustus, one should reconsider that assessment. At Augustus, Gutenberg was also surrounded by conservative German figureheads. Some of these men were serving in high offices in the German government before, but have fallen in disgrace of public opinion. due to their closeness to the far right, like Hans-Georg Maaßen, the former head of the German Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution. When one looks closely, one can identify a dark web around Gutenberg that connects him with active and former politicians, heads of state and governments, businesses and startups, investors, even the Catholic Church and Russian spies, as we have seen in the recent Wirecard scandal. But for now, let's focus on Gutenberg's apparently legally obtained thesis. While in the US, Gutenberg also worked as a distinguished statesman at the Center of Strategic International Studies in Washington, D.C., where he focused on global trends and current political, economic, and financial and technological issues. He also devoted much time to studying the banking system in the US and its general history. His thesis connects, among other things, correspondent banking to ancient Babylon and the Crusaders. An exposition, as he himself claims, is unique in its kind. Bible prophecy reveals that Europe will get an unusually cunning and strong leader that is also noted for his deceptive skills. A prophecy in Daniel 8:23 reads, "And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. This individual will not come to power through the usual democratic process, but rather in a much more unique way." Daniel 11, verse 21 reads, "And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries." These prophecies and many others have repeatedly led us to observe Gutenberg very closely. His recent activities give reason to do so all the more. The late theologian Herbert W. Armstrong prophesied that a massive banking crisis in America could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a new world superpower larger than the US. This unification has been prophesied in various Bible passages. For a detailed explanation on Mr. Armstrong's Bible-based prophecies, you can request a free copy of our booklet, He Was Right. But given today's economic conditions, it is almost inevitable for another economic crisis to hit the US. Europe's response to this crisis will determine if it will fall with the US or replace it as the world's superpower. The Bible reveals in Isaiah 23 that world trade will soon center around Europe. Many scoff at this prophecy today and see the future rather as remaining in the US or shifting to China. But Gutenberg's recent activities reveal in an astonishing way how he is preparing to lead Europe into its prophesied destiny. Revelation 17 indicates that an hour will come when the people of Europe and the heads of government will put their trust in one man. Most people and even most politicians are clueless about economics and the rise of new technologies and how they connect. They would easily fall for a man that promises them deliverance in times of economic crisis. The stage is now being set for this stunning prophecy to be fulfilled. The summer of 2020 has definitely brought Gutenberg into the public's mind again, either positively or negatively. In January, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fluey asked, "Is KT zu Gutenberg about to come to power?" At a time when almost no one even thought of him, Mr. Fluey concluded that his hour may now have come. Today, Germany's media and people are again foaming over their once bright star. To the very least, it is interesting to note that Gutenberg is again in the news, just after Mr. Fluey indicated he would be.
Thank you, Josue. The fact that Gutenberg has been associated now with two companies that have fallen into scandal, in addition to what happened with his first thesis, it definitely seems it would be easy for people to look askance at this and to kind of keep him at arm's length. I find it interesting. It's hard to know for sure when we're in the middle of this, that you're looking at in terms of the prophecies that we're so focused on. This may actually be evidence of his character that that would make him even likelier to fulfill those prophecies. And you've also looked at this historically and just the way that the German people tend to respond to maybe individuals who have that kind of a bit of a stain on their character. Maybe you could just talk about that aspect of it.
Yes, many people do dismiss the fact that Gutenberg could come to power due to those scandals. But the way he talks and the way he interacts with people, he has an unusual sway over people and the audience he captivates. And we saw a similar trend with Adolf Hitler. When he was accused of things, he captivated the audience so much that he distracted of the accusations that he was held accountable for and got his points across, and that got him more and more attention, and the public saw what he stood for, and then he stood for it despite all those scandals, and that rose him in popularity. And the people were at a time in a time of great crisis, and at a time the people had hopes into him because of that. And maybe in other times they wouldn't have seen him as their savior as they did, but due to the crisis they really put their hopes into it, because he was able to persuade them and his eloquence was able to move them along and overlook those scandals. In the case of Gutenberg, this is really interesting, because Europe needs to stand up economically to prove itself against the US and China. And many leaders in Europe may even see it as necessary that Europe has to do that by dubious means, that it might even have to use fraud, that companies can rise to succeed, and then once they successfully pull investors on their side, they then have a footholding in different countries like in China and the US, and that they can then use the technology and the money they have to further what they already gained.
Well, we certainly appreciate you keeping your eyes on what's happening over there. Our editor-in-chief has drawn a lot of attention to this man, we do need to keep our eyes on him. We've been talking to Josue Michels about Carl Theodor zu Gutenberg, a man we see as a potential candidate to become Chancellor of Germany. Josue is working on an article about this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. In the meantime, just to understand why we're so interested in this, read Gerald Fleury's booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. We'll put a link to it in the show notes for today's program. And thank you, Josue.
Good to be back.
It's time for today's last word.
Race relations in America are dangerously inflamed right now. The only way to arrive at a peaceful solution is to look at this issue spiritually. Oh, God is not white, and he's not black or any other color either. The Holy Bible describes God plainly and says that he is radiantly bright. He shines like the sun in its full strength. His eyes are as flames of fire. This brilliant being is above race. And yet he created the human race, including all the varieties in color and the physical features of the different races. Just like he fashioned all the different flowers and trees and fish and beasts, he is a God of variety. So does the Creator regard one race as superior or inferior to any other race? Absolutely not. The scriptures say clearly, God has made of one blood all nations of men. It says God is no respecter of persons, but in every nation, he that fears him and works righteousness is accepted with God.
It says, God will have all men to be saved and to come unto the knowledge of the truth. Do you believe those words of the Bible? Prejudice and bigotry are sins. They are sins against the creator of man. They are a violation of God's commandments. God doesn't want any race to suffer at the hands of another race. He wants every race and every nation to live in peace and prosperity, and they will in the coming kingdom of God. But you can look around and see that this world today is not governed by God. Scripture reveals that it is actually ruled by what the Bible calls the God of this world, the adversary, Satan the devil, who deceives the whole world. So as we speed toward the end of present civilization, under Satan's influence, race problems are getting worse, and they're going to get a whole lot worse. God's prophecies speak plainly of the racial discord that we see in the world today that is so prevalent, and it also reveals its explosive outcome. Race problems are going to get a whole lot more devastating than they are already today. Again, racism is sin, and sin always brings a penalty. And that's true on all sides. Hatred of any race toward any other race, even one's own race, which we see more and more today, it's always going to produce problems. This is not a modern problem by any means. This has been going on for as long as human beings have lived on Earth. Like historian Paul Johnson once wrote, the historical evidence suggests that racism in varying degrees is ubiquitous in human societies, so much so that it might even be termed natural and inevitable. Natural and inevitable. Why would racism be natural and inevitable? What is the cause of that? Well, most people assume that the root cause is the oppressive actions of the majority against the minority. And there is plenty of evidence, and there are plenty of cases where that is a genuine problem. But that's not the whole story. If you're looking at this spiritually, the truth of the Bible is that we have all sinned and come short of the glory of God. And we all have to recognize our guilt before our Creator. The underlying cause of the sin of racism, the sin of assuming that your race is superior to other races or looking down on another person because of the color of his skin, the underlying cause is giving into the evil pull of human nature, which is susceptible to the influence of Satan the devil. And human nature is common to all of us of every color. And until human nature is changed, real, lasting, universal solutions to the race problems are going to remain elusive. Satan's influence is growing today. He's playing up on people's emotions. He's using tools like a sense of grievous and injustice and getting people to focus on slights and wrongs rather than on blessings and opportunities. He's stirring up frustration. He's stirring bitterness and envy and anger, hatred, wrath. He's using every poisonous emotion he possibly can. And that unrestrained emotion and that undisciplined conduct, that is human nature run amok. And it shows Satan's growing influence in the world today. In order to get proper perspective on this problem, we've got to view this not as black or white or person of any particular color. We have to look at what's happening the way God does. The Bible promises that every single injustice in the world is going to be corrected. Every man and woman is going to be judged justly by the Almighty God. The problems will be solved, and it's going to happen even within our generation. But it's not going to happen until Satan's influence is eliminated and human nature is changed and people learn to stop hating one another. They actually learn to love one another. If you feel like you suffer from prejudice and discrimination God tells you, don't let resentment and bitterness and hatred come into your heart. That's not going to help the problem, but it will hurt you. Those kinds of emotions consume human character like cancer. They're going to destroy anybody who harbors them. Bitterness, resentment, hatred. Remember, God is the God of people of every color, and your race has nothing whatsoever to do with whether God is going to extend the promise of eternal life to you. If you repent, if you accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, if you receive God's gift of the Holy Spirit. But if and as long as we defy God's laws and we fail to trust Him to fight our battles and we take it on ourselves to bring about our version of justice by force, then we're going to be denied everything that we seek, both in this life and in the life to come. To trust in violence is to distrust God. We're never going to attain God's kingdom by using force contrary to God's perfect law of love. God is not deaf. He hears the cry of those who are oppressed. He heard the people of ancient Israel when they were enslaved by the Egyptians, and He did deliver them, but it was in His time and it was in His way. We can't dictate to God when and how He should deliver. We've got to leave that job to Him. Will you trust God? If you will, then His way of just waiting on deliverance from Him rather than taking matters into your own hands, that's going to make sense. And you can, in the meantime, practice the way of love, the way of forgiveness, the way of peace. And that's only going to happen if you're really looking at the situation from God's perspective.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Andrew Miller, and Josue Michels. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Leonardo da Vinci. Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.